Welcome to KPFK, established in 1959 on the Pacifica Radio Network, a broadcast service of, by, and for the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake. People power is on your radio.
Good afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My friend and co-host Jim Lafferty is out on a little sabbatical, but rest assured he'll be back with us later this summer. And in the meantime, I want to take the opportunity to thank my guest, co-producer, and co-host today, Marilise Romero de Aquino, who helped put together today's show. Marilise is the founder of Legal Allies, which aims to provide culturally sensitive and trauma-informed legal services to women and their families. Thanks so much for all your work on this show today, Marilise. Say hi.
Hi, Maria. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here with you today.
Yes, yes. Well, hopefully you'll be on more often as well. So we have a great show lined up for you today. In our first half hour, we'll explore the subject of immigration and marriage and how the U.S. recently denied a U.S. citizen's husband the right to live in this country, not because of anything he did or said, but because of his tattoos. Then in our second half hour, we'll speak with housing rights attorney Roberta Ponce from the nonprofit law firm Basta about how tenants and their lawyers are working together to keep people housed. So let's jump in. With election season heating up, the subject of immigration law and policy is making headlines once again. People and politicians love to argue over immigration, but we rarely hear stories about individual people who are caught in the immigration system. Today, you'll hear about a Los Angeles lawyer who fell in love and married someone who just happens to have been born in El Salvador. Their story exemplifies the hardships that many couples face here in the U.S. when a spouse is undocumented. It's especially difficult when the law requires the spouse to leave and have their case evaluated in their home country. In the case of Department of Homeland Security versus Sandra Munoz, Ms. Munoz's spouse, Luis Asensio Cordero, traveled back to his own home country of El Salvador to complete a final interview to obtain his residency. But his case was denied. However, the couple weren't told the reasons for his denial until after they'd waged a long legal battle. To talk about this with us today, and the case that's currently pending before the Supreme Court of the United States, we have with us Ms. Munoz's lawyer and friend, Alan Diamante of Diamante Law Group. Alan has practiced law since 1995 and is a California State Bar certified specialist in immigration and nationality law. He fights for the civil and human rights of individual immigrants, as well as for broader policy changes through class actions and other high-profile court cases. He served on numerous boards and has been honored by groups, including our very own National Lawyers Guild, for his outstanding public service and commitment to justice. Alan Diamante, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Hello, Maria. Could I call you guys the M&Ms?
Please.
Okay. I'm glad to be here. I like to thank KPFK and the Lawyers Guild for this opportunity. And I could jump in and tell you all about the case. I'm not the lawyer that fell in love with somebody. It was Sandra Munoz. Yes. She is a lawyer from East LA, and she was a student of Jaime Escalante.
Wow.
And she is a great person. I went to law school with her. And when I found out what was going on with her, I took the case and it was all with the Supreme Court. Now, let me give you the facts of the case. She had known Luis, her husband, for many years, but the only way he could get a green card is leave the country and go to the consulate. He couldn't do it here. So the other party is not DHS, but Department of State, okay? Mm-hmm. And basically, they did everything correctly. He had applied for a waiver for his unlawful presence. He did it. It got approved. He got his appointment at the consulate. He went to the consulate, and he waited for a decision. They denied him. He waited for an answer. They didn't give him an answer until 3 years later when we filed in district court. They gave him the answer. It was because his tattoos. What does he have? Sigmund Freud. Some cards. He has a feeder mask. Nothing that says MS or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And he's never been convicted of a crime. And they were charging him under a section of the law that says, under 1182A382 of USC, 8 USC, that says that you are inadmissible to the United States if you are likely to commit any crime. Very vague, right?
Yeah.
That's what they denied him under. So we fought it in district court, took it on appeal. On appeal, the circuit court told us that my client had a liberty interest as a wife, okay, of Louise to get her case properly adjudicated because they never gave an answer and so forth. And the government did a writ of certiorari or a writ of cert, and it was granted. So now we had a fight in the Supreme Court, and we argued it, and we're waiting. That's where we're at.
Alan, we are talking to maybe an audience that does not understand immigration law, does not really, they think that, well, you're married to a U.S. citizen, that's easy. But how many couples are in this same situation that their spouse have to leave the country?
Many,
right?
The only people that could get a green card here are those people that enter lawfully, okay? And they're not many. Most of the people entered unlawfully.
And in this particular case, how long has the husband been away from the United States, being in El Salvador?
About 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
And he was living here in the United States about 10 years lawfully with his daughter. His daughter lives here, and she's a United States citizen as well. And it was very sad that they denied it. It's the consulate, you see. They have unfettered power to deny somebody. And we filed in district court. They made an argument of that the federal court didn't have jurisdiction. And we got beyond that. And that's why we're in the Supreme Court now. It's very sad what they did. And I don't think the section law should be there. It's too vague. What is he going to do? Jaywalk in the United States in the future? We don't know. It's too vague.
Right. Well, can you talk about that, the constitutional issue that's before the United States Supreme Court? Because not just any case can get to the United States Supreme Court, right? What is that, the exact issues that are being debated or that you already debated, I understand.
Yes. The Supreme Court narrowed the issues. Mm-hmm. So these are the issues as they narrowed them. Whether a consular officer's refusal of a visa to a U.S. citizen's non-citizen spouse impinges upon a constitutionally protected interest, liberty interest, right? Her interest to be with her husband, okay? There's case law going through the 60s. Her interest to be with her husband live in the United States. And then they say, whether assuming that such a constitutional interest exists, notifying a visa applicant that he was deemed inadmissible under 8 U.S.C. 1182 A3A2 suffices to provide any process that is due process, right? And in this particular case, the government argued just citing the statute is enough. They don't have to explain. Just citing the statute is enough. And we argue that it wasn't enough. They had to explain and they had to give us an opportunity to rebut whatever they were saying.
And Alan, what do you think are your chances or this case chances that the court will grant your petition?
I'm optimistic, but at the same time, Alito and Clarence Thomas could be a hindrance for us.
And do you foresee better policies for spouses of U.S. citizens in the future?
If we are granted in the cases in our favor, I most definitely do. The consulate will have to change its way of doing things. Just denying people without telling them why they're being denied. Now, in this case, I didn't mention it. We submitted a letter or a declaration from a gang expert that said that the tattoos were not gang related. And they still wouldn't budge. So there you go. Hopefully in the future, they'll change their ways.
Wow. So has this gone through, when did it first start? So it's gone through several presidential administrations, it sounds like.
We started with Obama.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is one.
She's been waiting about 8 years to see her husband. It's probably 9. It's terrible. And the last 8 years have been very tough on her. Her mother died. Her sister died. It's been very difficult being away from her husband. She needs him for support. And this can't be the American way, right? They have to change this.
Well, especially when we talk about due process, you know, people use that phrase all the time. But what really does that mean? It means that we're on notice of what's expected of us so that we can follow a rule of law. We always say, oh, this is supposed to be a rule of law country with a constitution. And due process simply means you have notice of what you're being accused of and then an opportunity to rebut, like you said. So what is the other side arguing on this?
They're arguing by just citing this section of the law, it's good enough. That's what they're arguing.
Kind of an absolute.
Basically, power. That they have ups. They can't. Their decision cannot be reviewed by courts, right? That's basically their doctrine that they are claiming,
of
right?
Non-constitution. Which are you talking about? The doctrine. Non-constitutionality or
no reviewability. No reviewability.
Non-reviewability. Okay. Yeah. They're arguing that doctrine, but not for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court didn't want to hear about that. But they argue that doctrine, and that would pretty much not give the court an opportunity to review. So they would be insulated by their decision. And that would be a violation of due process as well.
And do you, I know we are talking about something that is very difficult, but do you see any possibility in the future that mixed families with mixed status that, for instance, children would have the right, a constitutional protected right, like in this case?
Yeah, good question. Does the child have a right, a U.S. citizen child, have a right to make similar arguments? It's a good question. We might go that route. But the route for Sandra was of a spouse, because there's case law on spouses, not of children. A lot of the children cases have failed in the past. And this is to be distinguished from cases of people in the United States fighting to stay here. This has to do with the consulate.
Yes. Because you mentioned that the spouse of Sandra has a U.S. citizen child as well, that probably has suffered, you know, because of the separation of her father.
No doubt. She's now 17. Wow. Can you imagine that? Her whole childhood away from her father.
But as Maria mentioned in the beginning of the program, immigration is the focus of the one of the focus of this next presidential election, and as an immigration attorney, I'm more concerned that the policies are not going to be helpful if one candidate wins over another candidate. I see, as an immigration attorney, a civil rights attorney, what are your concerns for this, for the future, for the elections?
I think immigration is being used as an issue in this campaign. Obviously, Donald Trump wants to deport everybody. And I have a feeling that Biden wants to secure the border. And there were similar issues with different presidents. They got to change the paradigm. Okay. They talk about, a crisis at the border. But what is the crisis? The crisis isn't that they don't have a wall. The crisis is that they killed over 700 people at the border in 2022. Okay, that's the crisis. Who killed them? I don't know. Probably MAGA. Some people from MAGA probably killed them. They might have starved. They might have been thirsty. I don't know. But over 700? That's the crisis. The government has to figure that out and figure what the solution is.
Well, for listeners just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. Mm-hmm. I'm Maria Hall. I'm here with my guest, co-host, and producer, Marilise Romero de Aquino, and we are speaking with immigration attorney Alan Diamante about a pending Supreme Court case with Sandra Munoz. And Alan, I wanted to ask, if the court does grant everything that you would hope that they would grant, what would change in the process of applying for residency for undocumented spouses, if anything?
Well, first of all, I want Luis to be back, okay?
Yeah.
Second of all, to answer your question, the Department of State will have to change their ways. They will have to give responses that we could respond to. You know, if they're denying someone, we need to know why they're denying so we could respond to that. And that has to change. You know, people, families are affected and people need to know. And this is a case of illegal immigration. This is a case of legal immigration gone wrong.
But this is the most common, actually, results in immigration law. I'm thinking, it's gone wrong in so many ways and so many issues.
Yeah, it has, unfortunately. That's the way they treat the migrants. They're on the bottom of the totem pole. That is true. And, you know, we have to live in a country where everybody has rights, civil rights, whether they have papers or not. They have civil rights. So I'm hoping they'll change their ways. I'm hoping this case will be granted. I'm hoping Luis will come back. He deserves to be with Sandra.
And do you know what he's doing in El Salvador, how he's coping with that separation? What he can tell us about Luis?
All I know, he has an ATV business in El Salvador. Uh-huh. So I guess for tourists or something to rent ATVs. That's all I know. He's trying to be optimistic for his wife, mm-hmm. but at the same time, he doesn't want to break the law. He has hope that this case could be granted and he could come in lawfully.
So Alan Diamante, talk a little bit about who are the people who are working with you? Who are the coalition? Who are the kind of forces for good coming in to help on this?
Well, Maria, I would be here all day if I gave you that answer. A lot of people have lended a hand. Here in LA, we had Carecen and Homies Unidos, a bunch of organizations, but also in other states, a lot of organizations. We had many other briefs that were filed with the Supreme Court. So hopefully they help. I feel like we're in good hands with all the support we're getting from other people. Is that a fair answer to your question?
Definitely. And as a follow-up, just kind of what keeps you going through all of this? I know a lot of people out there are tired and feeling hopeless. What keeps you doing the work, getting up every day and continuing to take on these really difficult cases?
Well, Maria, I've been tired for about 10 years now, but I'm a fighter for justice. And as long as I see injustice, I want to get involved. And what else could I say? It's very unjust what they're doing, right? And hopefully things will change. We have to keep fighting, right? Immigration attorneys have to keep fighting. There's a lot of things that need to be changed. I didn't even talk about the people that are represented by non-attorneys that do this. They go to the Department of State in their country, and they're not told about the risks, and they're stuck in their country. That's a terrible thing. So we got to fight that too, right? It's an injustice. So there's a lot of things to fight. And we just hope that people get proper representation from attorneys, not fake attorneys.
But I know this is a matter of another topic, but they say that it's actually that is a limited number of immigration attorneys, given that there are so many people, for instance, filing asylum cases, that's what happens, that they are not being represented.
Yes, I agree with you. Unfortunately, there are many non-immigration attorneys, mm-hmm. and there's many fake attorneys. And they apply for asylum for people without knowing what the risks are. And it's terrible to find out when your case is denied that you shouldn't have taken the risk. And I see it all the time. I've been seeing it for almost 30 years.
Well, thank you for being here, Alan. And also, thank your clients, because I know it's not hard to choose this path of being trying to come back lawfully. Many clients decided that they have no hope, then they cross the border again unlawfully, and that's extremely sad, a big no-no, but you understand the sometimes emotional hardship of these decisions. So thank you for being here. Thank you for agreeing to talking to us about this case.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And you're absolutely right. Like Luis, he could always come back illegally, mm-hmm. and live in the shadows. but he chose to stay in El Salvador and write it out. And I have a lot of respect for him. And for all those people that are trying to get papers, they're what we call valiente. They're brave in what they're doing, because you never know. And if they leave the country, go to the consulate, they won't know. So you have to be brave. And I hand it to all the brave people out there that are giving it a shot. I just hope they're making the right decision with their representative.
And finally, Alan, where can people find out more about you and your work, as well as the story about how to help Sandra Munoz, and then also just some any other resources that you want to shout out and amplify to our listeners?
Yeah, you could go to my website, diamantelaw.com, and get a lot of information there. And if you want to call me, you can call me. I know there's a lot of people out there who are similarly situated. Why? I met them, so I know. So a lot of people with tattoos. I know one guy who got denied because he had LA on his arm. And they said it's a tattoo. I guess whoever denied him didn't like the Dodgers.
I was going to say, that's the Dodgers tattoo.
Right. So you never know. Call me anytime. Reach out. And we'll be here to help you any way we can. And Maria, good job. Thank you. And I hope Miss Romero de Aquino, I wish you the best too. And I hope KPFK will continue its fundraising and do what it has to do to continue its work for many, many, many years ahead.
Thank you so much. It has great music too, right? I love the music.
It does.
Okay. And Maria, if people start calling us the Eminem, we know that was you, Alan.
Yes. Uh-huh. Exactly. For any credit.
It's my fault.
Well, thank you.
All right, you guys.
Thank you,
Alan,
for taking time out of your busy, busy day. Oh, thanks so much. And we hope
No problem. My pleasure. You guys take care. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Wonderful. So we'll take D'Angelo Jones. We'll take a very brief pause for a station ID break just a couple minutes early, but we may as well do that now. And then we'll be right back to hear more about the battles being waged in Los Angeles eviction courts. Stay tuned.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind, and Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
Welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friends. As I mentioned at the start of the show, I'm Maria Hall. My co-host Jim Lafferty is out on a little sabbatical, but he'll be back in August. It'll fly by, though. It always does. And today I'm so much appreciating having the help of my friend, my guest co-producer and co-host today, immigration attorney Marilise Romero de Aquino. So Marilise, how was that? Are you your first time?
Yeah, thank you, Maria. Well, it feels like a conversation with friends and having meeting Alan. I mean, I met Alan before, but meeting him, getting to know more about him. But I just wanted to wrap this conversation. So many people ask why people don't fix their papers, why people still remain undocumented. I hope that story shed some light on how difficult is a path to become legally in this country, become a lawful permanent resident in this country, and all the decision making that goes into that process.
No, thank you for that. And I know it is a very, in Los Angeles, we have just such great lawyers and people who are collaborative and coalitions working together. And woo, but it's still a challenge. And speaking of challenges and friends, we are now going to turn to another topic and another wonderful guest, another one of those amazing lawyers that I always say 99% of lawyers make the rest of us look bad. But we have the 1% of amazing lawyers, the lawyers you would want to go and have a coffee with. And I'll introduce her in just 1 second. We are now turning to the subject of housing law. This week, the Orange County Register published a story identifying Los Angeles as the least affordable city in the United States for home buyers, people who want to buy a home. And for renters, unfortunately, the picture isn't much rosier. LA isn't that far behind San Francisco, San Jose, and New York City when it comes to the highest rents. And unfortunately, the natural consequence of that, the combination of high housing prices and high rents, is creating a boon for corporate landlords who are gobbling up homes, apartment buildings, and mobile home parks, funneling more and more profit to Wall Street and lobbyists like the California Apartment Association, who then put their money into further stripping away the hard-fought legal rights of tenants. But it's not too late to fight back, and our next guest is doing just that. She is attorney Roberta Ponce, whose day job is spent in court, relentlessly fighting for the rights of tenants, and she loves it. Roberta is a staff attorney at BOSTA, a nonprofit organization founded in 2005 that is dedicated to advocating for tenants' rights, preventing homelessness, and eliminating substandard housing. I keep getting tongue-tied today. Welcome to the show, Roberta Ponce.
Hola, hola, compañeras. Nice to see you virtually, talk to you. And actually, the previous segment is a nice segue because I believe that racial and economic justice are married to access to housing. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of outside influences trying to divorce them, but boy, they're married. Racial and justice equality with access to housing. Mm-hmm. So how are you, ladies?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Wonderful to see you, Roberta.
Nice to see you.
Yes. So we want to just started off with, what are some of the biggest challenges and changes you've seen in eviction courts since all of the pandemic eviction moratoria ended? For a while during the pandemic, we had a little pause on most evictions. But now, what's happened? Have the floodgates opened or what's going on?
So myself and a lot of my colleagues like Alexi Hong and Elena Pop and my very good office mate, Christian Roldan, what we're seeing a lot of is pretextual Alice evictions where plaintiffs are coming in and saying that they want to move into housing units that, you know, they're not moving into, or that they say they're moving their kids into, but they're really not because they come from affluent areas. And there's no way that they're moving into, you know, South Central or East LA or Montebello. So we're seeing a lot of that. We've seen an uptick in process servers providing declarations of service under questionable circumstances. I just had a case the other day where opposing counsel kept trying to get me to produce my client. And I'm sure it was so that the process server could identify him. And when I didn't, he was like, oh, well, then sign a waiver saying that that you're waiving your client's appearance in court. And I was like, no. So we're seeing that and an uptick in cases just generally. I mean, literally, the big firms, Block, KTS, they're making money hand over fist with just a lot of evictions. And what we're seeing a lot as well, because some of the bigger plaintiffs' counsel, usual plaintiffs' counsel, yeah, the landlords' counsel can't take them. Landlords are doing a lot of pro per themselves. So, yeah, so those are the biggest changes that I would say that I've seen since the protections ended.
And just as a follow up, what would inspire a landlord to want to say that they're going to move into this place where they're obviously not going to move into?
Because it's a shortcut. I mean, already the eviction process, the unlawful detainer process, is such a sped up way for landlords to get tenants out and for them to have access to their unit. But now if they come in and say, oh, we're moving in, now it speeds it up even more because they're trying to circumvent a trial. They want to just write a limited small check in what they're calling relocation fees, which are really not, because there's actually a table, and relocation fees go up depending on how long tenants have been living there, whether there's disabilities, whether there's children with disabilities. And yeah, so that's why landlords want to fake that they're moving back into their units when they're not.
And I want to say I practice immigration law, but I also practice family law, representing survivors. And I represented briefly tenants with Diane Prado in her organization. And I see here a strategy that BASTA is actually pioneering, which is a strategy of bringing all eviction defense cases to jury trial. I remember Diane would say, guys, ask for jury trial. So I see that you guys are doing this. This is quite controversial, wasn't it? Talking why exercising one's right to a jury trial can be so powerful.
So I always say to my clients that going to trial is their constitutional right. Mm-hmm. They have a constitutional right to have their issues heard before a judge. Sometimes opposing counsel will try to railroad them into seeing a commissioner, a pro tem judge, but they have a right to hold out for an actual judge. Mm-hmm. And the effort to get defendants, tenants in front of judges is actually a coalition effort. LATU, the Tenants Union, BASTA, Eviction Defense Network, BETSEDIC, Public Counsel, and the community at large is applying pressure to the judicial system to get defendants, tenants in front of judges. And that's so important because prior to this effort, tenants had no rights and they were just ushered through. Mm-hmm. And you still see it. You still see appearance attorneys on the sixth floor at Stanley Mosque, which is where I predominantly work, but at all the courthouses, trying to rush a defendant into accepting a bad deal or no relo fees or to pay for the plaintiff's attorney's fees. And all of those are just things that most of the orgs and the community groups, and BASTA for sure, does not settle for. We always make sure that we get tenants the best rights possible. And the best way to do that is through a trial. And of course, landlords don't want to pay for, you know, a 3-4 day trial that gets expensive at $5,000 per day, because that's what the big landlord firms are charging them, like $5,000 to $7,000 a day. So landlords don't want to pay that.
And also, Roberta, can you talk about a jury trial? Are jury trials allowed in eviction cases?
Absolutely. And you should always, always get a jury, because while the trier of fact, the judge, might understand the statutes and laws very well. Getting in front of a jury, everybody knows someone who rents with as many evictions as there are. Either they've been evicted or they know someone that's evicted. I was selecting a jury about a month ago, and you only get a certain amount of preemptions as a lawyer saying like, oh, I don't want to choose them. And you could tell that the plaintiff's counsel was frustrated because they ran out of people, you know, they ran out of preemptions, you know, the option to strike someone. And there were still a lot of people on the jury panel that had been evicted or knew someone that was evicted. So, yeah, that's what the numbers reflect.
But isn't that this a difficult, you know, endeavor for somebody who is self-representing, is self-represented, you know, which is the majority of the case, correct?
I don't know if it's the majority. I confess to not knowing the statistics on that, but it is difficult. But what a lot of us do is if we're in court, we act as a friend of the court, and we'll step in and say, you know, as a friend of the court, blah, 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 and then interject with something that maybe the self-represented tenant is not aware of, something they can ask for, or the fact that, you know, jury documents or trial documents can be fluid because maybe opposing counsel is trying to say, you know what, the time already passed and you can't alter the documents, when in reality you can. And we might know that, so we'll interject that as a friend of the court. Or we'll help, people amend answers. They'll be told they can't amend an answer. We'll help them amend an answer. So there's a lot that we do, myself and my colleagues. I see it all the time.
Wow. Well, at least that's good that in downtown LA courthouse. But what about, talk about the LA's Right to Counsel Coalition a little bit, if you will. I know BASTA is a member. And this coalition of organizations has been fighting for an ordinance in LA to provide free legal counsel to all low-income tenants, sort of like a public defender, which is how it's been explained to me. And I know that both San Francisco and New York do have such programs. I think they're still working out, you know, trying to tweak the programs. Do you think such an ordinance deserves the public support? And if so, why?
Absolutely, because our society does better when we strengthen and offer support and resilience to the most vulnerable. And unless we start taking responsibility for uplifting everyone, then our democratic values are compromised. One of the things I always say in court, no matter what, is due process. Tenants have a right to due process. And yes, it's counterbalance. What judges always say, or opposing counsel will say, is landlords have a property interest, which in this country is like huge. And I never say no, they do have a property interest, but that's counterbalanced against due process. And due process has to be as important or more important if we're going to be a society that's functioning. People need secure housing so they can go to work. Kids need secure housing so they can go to their regular schools. And if you're going to grow a citizenry that's educated, that has democratic principles at heart, they have to have housing. Because if they're unhoused, how invested are they going to be in a democracy?
And I want to interject also that I see that the courts play a role in a housing policy, but definitely the state or the city should have been also helping with these housing issues. Do you see any assistance coming from officials, city officials?
I mean, cities like LA, San Francisco, are more progressive than, mm-hmm. say, like San Diego or areas mm-hmm. of Orange County. But it's on all the activists out there to put pressure on the politicians to change policy, because it's a cooperative effort. It isn't just the lawyers. It isn't just the community activists. It isn't just the politicians. It's everyone working together, because yes, the community activists put pressure on the entire system, but it's lawyers who go in and can represent tenants and create law or overturn law. And then it's the politicians that can make policy. So it's a group effort, and we're only as strong as our weakest link. So the activists have to keep it up. The lawyers have to keep it up. And the politicians have to come through with policy. And if not, then we need to reelect other politicians and get politicians in there that reflect the need for a just society.
And if I can interject the immigration issue here. So I know that BASTA prides itself on representing tenants regardless of national origin or immigration status. Talk about the diversity of the tenants you represent and why it's important to have a culturally diverse group of staff and attorneys to assist them.
You know what? I love my work at BASTA. I love you, D-Work. I think it has such purpose. It's soul-sucking work, and it's hard, but I think that defending people's right to housing is so important. I think it's the most important legal work that there is. And what I like about BASTA's approach is that we take everyone in regardless of citizenship status, regardless of their ability to pay. I just had a case come up on Dia de las Madres where a mother was going to be evicted, and she had not gotten her notice. She hadn't gotten the complaint. And my direct supervisor, Diana Alvarado, wrote a motion to set aside her judgment. We went in on an ex parte, and she didn't get evicted on Dia de las Madres or Mother's Day. So, you know, her family was there to celebrate with her. And I don't know that we're the only group that does that, but that's what I like about BASTA. The door was open. She came in, she needed help. And, you know, three or four of us banded together and put that help together. And we have everyone, poor people, people, immigrants, people from Central America. I just went to do a presentation at a high school, maybe three blocks from here. And it was a parents group, and we addressed their questions regarding evictions. A lot of them brought their answer templates. I revised them. My office mate, Christian Roldan, did a presentation at East LA Courthouse to some families who had some immigration questions. So that's a really unique thing about BASTA. We're very, very rooted in the community, and we try to respond to everyone's housing questions, eviction questions, and it's a very traumatizing, scary process.
Yeah. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall. I'm here with my guest, co-host, and producer, Marilise Romero de Aquino, and we're speaking with housing rights attorney Roberta Ponce. So, Roberta, speaking of immigration status, do the laws that protect tenants differentiate between citizens and non-citizens? Talk about this, please. Do undocumented people have the same rights, civil rights, human rights under U.S. laws?
So the court system will make you think that you don't have rights if you're an immigrant, but actually you're protected regardless of your citizenship status. And you most definitely must advocate for translators, interpreters in whatever language you speak. I had a case where the woman spoke K'iche and there was actually an interpreter. We had to wait and postpone trial a few days to get the K'iche interpreter to come in. But yes, and that's part of due process, and that's part of the constitutional protections. And the minute anyone steps one foot in the United States, just one foot, they have their covered, cloaked, protected by all the constitutional rights. And I know that several forces are trying to shortcut, chip away at our constitutional rights, but they're still there. And regardless of citizenship status, you're protected.
And since I work with domestic violence, do you represent survivors of domestic violence as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I'll reference my office mate, Christian Roldan. We were just discussing that we feel like social workers, because we'll ask about their job, whether they have childcare, and we try to maybe postpone tenants' trials until we can get them more situated financially, so that they can, maybe they'll get evicted where they're at, but they'll be able to save a little money to move somewhere else, have a job, and have childcare intact, and be able to move forward in a more holistic sense, instead of just addressing the UD and saying, well, we don't care if you don't have childcare. We don't care if you don't have a job. It's the whole person that we deal with. And that's what makes UD work, I think, so amazing. And I wouldn't choose any other area of law at all.
And also, we know that particularly the poor, and when they have a pet, they face hardships, you know, moving into or keeping their housing or moving to a housing. And there is a new bill that is called AB 2216 by Assembly Member Matt Honey, a Democrat from San Francisco. So I understand that California Apartments Association has lobbied against this law, and there's now a carve out that the bill will only apply to buildings with more than 15 units. So can you talk about this bill?
So let me just start by saying that there is a fabricated problem regarding pet status. And I say fabricated because there's not really a problem. It's just being engineered by landlords, by insurance companies, to get more money out of the poor. Because the real truth of the matter is that landlords are more capable of absorbing the costs involved with any pet damage that may result. But they're trying to make it seem as though, but for all these pets causing all these problems, then landlords would just have perfect units when, you know, they should be in there taking care of flooring and carpeting and painting and mold and leaky windows and all of that, instead of blaming problems on pets. So let me just start by saying the problem is fabricated. But yes, the new bill does state that in units where there's 15 or more units, landlords can't ask for your pet status, whether you have a pet. There's a cap on how much of a security deposit they can put. cap it at $1,000. They cannot, there's some things that are iffy, sketchy, like it doesn't cover exotic pets. So you might run into an unscrupulous landlord that'll say maybe a Siamese cat is, you know, exotic, or a turtle is exotic. But yeah, overall it's a pretty good bill with, protections. It was initially going to go into effect in January 2025, but it got postponed until April. But yeah, there's some good and bad things. I think that it should apply to all landlords, regardless of whether you're a bigger unit, a mega landlord, or whether you are just, you know, renting out a single unit, because the fact of the matter is that pets help with mental health and stability, and teach kids responsibility, and help families stay together. And why wouldn't you as a society want to make sure that mental health is being addressed? I mean, the pandemic hit all of us as a big surprise. And who's to say that with the way people are compromising the planet, that there won't be another pandemic right around the corner? And we should have mental health fixes, mental health cures, like pets, instilled in our families, so that people have pets instead of automatic medications and shots. And yeah, pets do a lot to keep families together.
Yes. And how often have we seen on the community apps, you know, that people have to rehome their pets because they're moving and their new landlord won't take pets. So I'm excited for that. I hope it'll pass, and I hope we can get more protections for pets. And unfortunately, we are running out of time. That went by really fast, as it always does. So Roberta, final thoughts, and where can people learn more about your work and the work of BASTA and some of the other coalitions out there?
So BASTA has a website, BASTA.com. They can go to Stay Housed LA, which is an umbrella organization that oversees all of the nonprofit organizations. There's a great website called Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles with a lot of self-help guides in English and Spanish. They deal with family law, immigration law, and unlawful detainer. It's a great website, and they can get the information in English and Spanish, as well as a great resource is the Law Library downtown.
Yes, you hit a lot of my favorite places. Well, thank you so much, Roberta Ponce. And that is all we have time for today. So in closing, I'll just say thanks to my guest co-host and producer today, Marilisa Romero de Aquino, as well as D'Angelo Jones on the station board, and our guests, Alan Diamante, and of course, Roberta Ponce. And until next week, I'm Maria Hall, and this has been the Lawyers Guild Show.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich of KPFK's weekly literary arts show, Bibliocracy. Support this program and the station by hitting the online donations button at kpfk.org. Choose the monthly donation option and, like me, become a sustaining member all year round. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Tom Nixon.
Patrick Milligan.
Art Podell.
Mark Humphrey.
Mary Catherine Alden.
We host the Saturday morning music show, Roots Music and Beyond, Saturday mornings, 7 to 9.
For a rare blend of
bluegrass,
Americana,
global roots,
artist interviews,
blues, and
the unexpected.
Invite us to breakfast. Why don't you?
Or along for a ride.
Start the day with music you won't hear anywhere else.
Saturday mornings,
7 to 9 on
Roots Music
and Beyond.